Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, the northern frontier of Christianity, the dedication of the Cathedral of Rome, and rendezvous by the Arch of Constantine with our popular Latin lover. When Michelangelo depicted God the Father separating land from water in the Sistine Chapel. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Friday 9th of November, the Pontifical Council for Culture, together with the Royal Norwegian Embassy to the Holy See and the Norwegian Institute in Rome, hosts a conference by the title of The Northern Frontier of Christianity, Exploring the Common Heritage of Norway and the Holy See. Ahead of this event, I was granted an interview with the man who called for it, the Ambassador of Norway to the Holy See, Rolf Trolle Andersen. For the record, Norway has enjoyed full diplomatic relations with the Holy See since 1982. I began by asking Ambassador Andersen what this common heritage might be from a historical point of view in terms of events and influences. Stay tuned.
Norway became Christian a little more than 1,000 years ago. And for the first over 500 years, we looked to Rome for guidance on all matters of moral, ethical, law, in many, many fields. And it has, of course, profoundly influenced the way of thinking of Norway today. So even after the Reformation, when the contact was not the same, it has then developed as a country based on the ethical, moral values that are common to us all.
But wouldn't Rome seem very distant to most Norwegians, and not just in geographical terms?
Well, yes, in one way, because we have been for so long a uniform Protestant country. But Norway has also been changing. It's become what I would call more a pluricultural society. Many people have come to Norway. Many of them are also Catholics. So the Catholic contingent in Norway has grown. It is now, I think, approximately 120,000 people. And they bring many new thoughts, interesting thinkings, and it leads to a, let's say, informed debate in the country, which is good for all of us. So although you're right that the Vatican and Rome, in a way, is far away, it is also influencing us indirectly through all the many people who have come to Norway with backgrounds from other cultures, including many Catholics.
Is it correct to say that in 2012, Norway distanced itself in a way from its Christian past? The evangelical Lutheran religion no longer became the state's official religion.
Well, I would think that it reflects the changing picture of the Norwegian society. All the principles that the Norwegian society are built upon remain the same. We, however, now open for others to have the right to express their views freely, while at the same time building our society on the same ethical values that we've done since the onset.
This conference that's taking place right now on the northern frontier of Christianity reflects a bit of a cultural exchange, doesn't it?
Yes, I'd say that. When I went to visit Cardinal Rabassi 2 or 3 years ago...
He's the president of the Pontifical Council for Culture.
One of the elements that we discussed was the lack of cultural contact between Norway and the Holy See. And if you like, this conference is kind of a reaction to that. It's a result of that thinking that Cardinal Rabassi made a point of, say, let us put our minds together and see if we can come up with something which we have in common. And there is nothing that we have more in common than our common heritage. So in a way, this is an attempt to look backwards to see what were those contacts, in which fields. And we've got some experts from Norway who will come down to speak about that. And at the same time, to pull the lines forward and to see what can we do with this. Is this, are there possibilities in the future that we can cooperate maybe better than we do today? I think it's a great pleasure to be in Rome to talk about how Norway and the Holy See can develop their relations, what we can do in the practical field, which areas we in fact can look at in the future, how we can use culture as a way in. I am very optimistic about the possibilities for the future.
And my thanks there go to the Ambassador of Norway to the Holy See, Rolf Trolle Andersen. And now, staying with this theme, I'd like you to listen to an interview with the organizer of this conference, the director of this Northern Nations Institute here in Rome. She's Professor Turit Carlson-Syme. She tells me all about Christian heritage in the land of St. Olave. As director of this Norwegian Institute in Rome, you've organized a conference focusing on the northern frontier of Christianity, exploring the common heritage of Norway and the Holy See. So what is this common heritage?
The common heritage in this case is particularly the medieval time, when, of course, Europe was one nation in terms of religion. There's always been quite a consciousness in Norway. We have the ancient cathedrals there still. We have kept the episcopal sites from that time, and we also have the king who was seen to Christianize Norway, even though it's much more complex history than that in reality, who was martyred. So there is a connection to the medieval history that's still very much alive in the national identity of Norway, even though we, since the Reformation, has been a Lutheran country or a Protestant country.
You were talking about the martyrdom of St. Olaf. That was the king.
It was, you're right. So you knew about him.
So tell me about St. Olaf a little bit.
St. Olaf was a Viking king and converted to Christianity in France, one of the crusades to France, and came back home and was fought by other local nobilities and was killed in a big battle in the middle of Norway near Trondheim or Nidaros, which was the name at the time. After his death, they claimed there were signs of his nails growing, his hair growing, I mean, miraculous events or developments in his body. So he lost the battle, but he won his cause in a way by this development afterwards. It was a very important event in the Christianization of Norway, even though it never happens quite like that in by one event only. It means that it had been prepared over the centuries, particularly along the coast where there had been close connections with England. But in the Norwegian storytelling, this has been the focus of Christianizations. His body, of course, was lost during the time of the Reformation, and one never really knows what happened to it. But the cathedral where it had been placed is still central, seen as a very important ecclesial center in Norway.
Which is this cathedral?
It's the Nidaros Cathedral, or the one in Trondheim, which is now called now. So one of those who would present a paper at this seminar is the cathedral archaeologist from Nidaros, who's been working particularly on the martyrion, which is the octagon, where one supposed the body of the martyr king was placed.
How present is this Christian heritage in Norway today? I mean, there's still a sort of knowledge of this king and saint.
I think for my generation, certainly. I wouldn't speak for the younger ones anymore, because population and existence in Norway has become so much complex.
It's become more secular.
More secular, but also more religiously mixed. So that I don't think one still tell the grand national stories as much as my generation would grow up. Particularly after the Second World War, there was a very strong national consciousness in Norway, which would still draw on the old identity as it had been shaped early in the 18th, 19th century. You have to remember that Norway became an independent state for the first time since the Middle Ages in 1907. And that also meant that there was a nation building happening.
Of course, culture opens all kinds of doors, doesn't it?
Culture opens many doors. And it also is seen as a common heritage, what you can see in Rome.
So in a sense, this conference is particularly interesting Yes. for you, isn't it?
It is. It is interesting for me. And I was very positive when the ambassador to the Holy See suggested that we do something like this. It was his idea, in fact.
I And my thanks there go to the director of the Norwegian Institute here in Rome, Professor Turid Karlsson-Seim. November 9th is the day the church marks the dedication of the Cathedral of Rome, the Basilica of St. John Lateran. It was 324 when Pope Sylvester installed his throne inside this basilica during the first official dedication, symbolically placing there the privileged seat of papal authority, one which reflects this church's claim to primacy in the world as Mother Church. In fact, if you look carefully at the facade of the basilica, the words Sacrosancta Lateranensis, Ecclesia omnium urbis et orbis, Ecclesiarum mater et caput, meaning the most holy Lateran church of all the churches in the city and the world, the mother and head, are engraved in stone between the great doors of the main entrance. Since 324, two other popes have rededicated the great cathedral, Pope Sergius III to St. John the Baptist, Pope Lucius II to St. John the Evangelist. Both saints are regarded as co-patrons of this cathedral, which, as is tradition in patriarchal cathedrals, is dedicated to Christ the Saviour. In a few moments, I'll be focusing my attention on the Basilica of St. John Lateran with my guest speaker. But before I introduce you to him, I'd like to share with you one of the best known of the medieval legends connected to this ancient building. I've asked my colleague Tracy McClure to read it for us.
The Emperor Constantine was suffering from leprosy when Peter and Paul appeared to him in a dream and promised him he would get well if he were baptized. The Pope at that time was Sylvester I, who had fled Rome for fear of persecution and lived in hiding among the forests of Mount Soracte. Reassured by the Emperor, he agreed to return to Rome and baptize Constantine. Healed of his leprosy, Constantine, as a sign of gratitude, built the Basilica of San Giovanni.
An unlikely legend for the Pope's cathedral, often referred to as the Lateran. After a Roman family who lived in the neighbourhood during the First Empire. But enough with speculation. It's time to join our guest, the Minister General of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement, Father Jim Pugliese.
The Pope is the 264th successor of Peter, and his prime title is the Vicar of Rome. His cathedral is St. John Lateran and not St. Peter's. Is there a specific reason for this?
Well, yes, mainly because St. Peter's was a pilgrimage place. It was the tomb of the martyr, and the cathedral church of the Diocese of Rome has always been St. John Lateran's. In fact, that was the residence of the popes up until really modern times, because, you know, the summer residence used to be the Quirinale, which is now the presidential residence. So the Pope lived in the city of Rome as its bishop. And because of political changes, that is, with the unification of Italy, the removal of the Papal States, then the Pope really was restricted to this little small area, which is known as Vatican City State, another country. But technically, St. Peter's is a very large church, but it's not even the parish church of the Vatican. You know, we all know St. Anne's is the parish church of Vatican City. So it's, we might just say, a big neighborhood church. But, of course, it's the center for all pilgrimage of people here to Rome, because where Peter was martyred and where Peter was buried became a place of worship from the early times, Constantinian times, who built the first church there and made it larger and larger. So technically, the Pope doesn't have a cathedral in the Vatican. There's just a parish church in the Vatican. But his cathedral, since his first and foremost, the most important title, is Bishop of Rome.
Why Bishop of Rome?
It's an ecclesiological reason, obviously, because it is a local church that was founded here in this city, first among the Jews who accepted Jesus as their Messiah. And then we know that Paul came to the city of Rome, and he worked not among the Jewish community, even though he was always Jewish, but among those were the Gentiles, the so-called pagans that would have been the Romans or the Greeks that lived here that were not of Jewish origin. And so this church is founded on these two pillars, Peter and Paul, one representing the unity of the peoples to whom the gospel is now being preached, those first to the house of Israel, and then secondly those, as Israel's mission was to all of the world, to those outside of the house of Israel. And so this became a local church, like a church in London, in New York, Chicago, Buenos Aires, wherever. And so this was the seat of its head, which would have been the Bishop of Rome. So this title is a very important ecclesiastical title because it's a sacramental title. The title of Pope is something that's added on as almost as an honor. We know that some churches call their bishops Papa, just like we do, and for example, the Coptic Church in Egypt. It just means it's the father of this church. And so the original title and the most venerated title is being the Bishop of Rome. And we notice in his coat of arms, the tiara is not there. It's the bishop's mitre. So he is underscoring the role that first and foremost is a sacramental role, that he is bishop of a local church, a particular church. It's not just any particular church. It's a church that was founded here in Rome by two apostles, Peter and Paul, and a church which was sanctified by the lives of many martyrs, which is the reason why Rome was so important, because of the quality of its faith in the past. And I'm sure with former Cardinal Ratzinger, this point is very, very important, especially as he looks towards the re-Christianization, if you want, of Europe, that it was founded on the blood of the martyrs, those men and women who gave their very lives for the sake of the gospel.
St. John Lateran is considered the mother and head of all churches of the city and of the world, as is written, as is inscribed over its entrance, Omnium Orbis et Orbis Ecclesiarum Mater et Caput. Can you explain?
It's the Mother Church because from its baptistry, which was the building which is separate from the church, but where all the Christians of this local church were born eventually, is born all churches. Now, this is a little bit a tricky interpretation. And the reason I say this is because the Mother Church is always referred to as Jerusalem, right? We have this tradition which is very, very strong among the Orientals and among the Westerners that the first church, the primary church, was the Church of Jerusalem presided over by James and not by Peter. And in fact, this is one of the ecclesial traditions that we have, that all communities descend originally from the church in Jerusalem, which has a symbolic sense because it represents the new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, the Jerusalem that will become the seat of the glory of God. But Rome, because of the fact that it took on importance not only from the religious point of view, where there are many people who accepted the faith, especially first, as I said before, among the Jews that were here, but also among all the other people that were living here, but also because of the fact that Rome acquires a political force. It became the center of the empire. It was the center of the empire at the time of Jesus' death. And so it was a force to be reckoned with. And we know that the role of religion and politics was always very, very important throughout the course of all of history, that emperors wanted to have a unified political base, but also because of the fact that religion many times served as the glue of that political base. And so when eventually the Roman Empire, the political aspect of it, falls into disuse, it is the Bishop of Rome who acquires the power, steps into the vacuum that is created to protect the people, to provide services, to provide judgment, etc. So the Pope then, the Bishop of Rome, begins to acquire a more of a political sense as well as a religious and spiritual sense. And so from this point of view, St. John Lateran is considered then to be the mother of all churches from which all churches are born because of the fact of his communion with its bishop.
And now we've spoken of Pope Benedict's cathedral with the Minister General of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement, Father Jim Pugliese. I'd like you to join my next guest. He's our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, with whom I had a very special rendezvous on one occasion by the Arch of Constantine. Constantine, whose influence on Christianity following the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, which took place 1,700 years ago this October. Do stay tuned. Father, we're standing here looking at the Arch of Constantine. This is a sort of a focal point in Christian history, isn't it? It represents something very special, a victory of an emperor, a very special emperor for Christian history.
Well, yes, the one who more or less who recognized Christianity as a religion. And so he stopped all the persecutions against Christianity. And up there you see on top, it's written in Latin, Instinctu Divinitatis. He conquered his enemy Maxentius, who was like the rival emperor, under divine inspiration. That's the famous time where they said up in the Ponte Milvio near the north of Rome, he saw the cross in the sky.
Yeah, maybe our listeners don't know. I've heard about it, but maybe our listeners
anyway,
don't
know. Anyway, there's the famous, it's kind of a, well, it's really kind of a fable, but anyway, that he saw the cross in the sky, and in written in Greek, although it's quoted in Latin, in hoc signo vinces, you will conquer in this sign. He had the Christian cross put on the shields of all of his soldiers.
Really?
Yes, that's the idea. And then
that's a part of the legend.
That's yeah. And then with these soldiers under the, as the Constantine art says, instinctu divinitatis, under the inspiration of the divinity, he conquered Maxentius and became the sole emperor of the Roman world. And
this
because
is
of this Christian business and this cross and so forth and so on, he was favorable toward Christianity and allowed it to exist as a religion.
This arch is an arch of triumph in battle, really, isn't it? That's what it represents.
Yes,
our listeners can't see it, so should we describe it? It's a marble structure, isn't it? Or
yeah,
is it in travertine?
Yeah, travertine, yes. And the fact is that you have pieces from many, many monuments in Rome that he collected and put together. And so you have pictures there of the emperor, like offering sacrifice of thanksgiving. I see on the left-hand side there, there are two pictures of the emperor there.
There are three arches, and the one on the left hand has this relief over it.
These are the two reliefs. And on the other side, he's addressing the soldiers over there. But these things are not his. They were taken from other emperors' monuments. So he collected all kinds of ruins around the city and pasted this thing together. So it all looks like Constantine and Let It Be.
That's a very Roman habit, isn't it? To pilfer from older buildings and insert them into newer ones.
Up to papal times, you know. Because they figure what was gone, and now we're in charge now. And so we will use the best things that other people had for our own good purposes.
I think Constantine was the first emperor to build, to actually have basilicas
then,
built.
Then he started, yes, the three, the old St. Peter's and all St. Paul's outside the walls. He had those first things. If I'm not mistaken, he also started St. Lawrence, if I'm not mistaken. The first original building of St. Lawrence is also Constantine.
But this proceeding? So does this precede the basilicas or not? Does this arch precede the basilicas or not?
No, this came after. Because most of these arches, you know, were dedicated by the Senate after the deaths of emperors. And so as to celebrate his whole life. And so he had all these different things he did in his life for Christianity or for the Roman Empire and Constantinople and all that stuff. And then they put up this arch to celebrate him.
And who did it exactly?
Well, the Senate, you know, the Senate after his time.
No one in particular?
No. Like up there you saw the Arch of Titus. You know,
that's on the Sacred Way.
That was put up after his death because he's already divinized. It's Divine Titus. And, of course, that title was given to the Senate, which means after his death he was canonized. You see, you probably realize the Christian should understand that Constantine in the Eastern Church is considered a saint. In the Western Church, we don't consider him Saint Constantine. And the fact is, you know, that's another kind of a fable that he was baptized on his deathbed, which is kind of like a convenient thing. And you have the famous statue there of Bernini in the Vatican. And above the statue of Bernini of Constantine and his horse, as he sees the cross in the sky, is a picture of his being baptized by Saint Sylvester, Pope Sylvester. And they say kind of the last minutes of his life, if it's even true, that he was ever baptized a Christian is another question. But
Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, better known as our popular Latin lover, was for many years papal Latinist and is now currently teaching in the United States. Finally, to end this broadcast, why not speak of Michelangelo and his central ceiling vault in the Sistine Chapel, a fresco unveiled 5 centuries ago. In a few moments, I'll be speaking of the Genesis creation series in which God the Father separates land from water. Our professor of fine arts, Breda Ennis, brings us a sound picture.
You You have again God the Father dressed in a pink robe with a reddish mantle. And what's lovely about this mantle is that you get the feeling that it's moving with him. He's moving forward, dividing the waters from the land, meaning that the people live on the land and also have the water for life and for fishing or whatever, and all the life the water contains, etc. So different areas of life. But on his face here, there's a lovely benevolent expression. He's looking downwards with affection, looking downwards with, well, with love, actually. It's a very nice face. And you see also here, Michelangelo has done his beard in such a way that you can't actually see his mouth. So it's like it's all beard from just below his nose right down.
Like a fake beard.
Yes, it's weird. It's like he's just stuck it on. And the same with the hair. And you notice, for example, his hands. One of his hands, the right hand, is raised and it's a paler colour. The left hand is sort of moved out as if he's going to start giving a blessing, or he's giving an order in this particular case to the elements. And you see, that's a darker hand. So it's almost like the hand that's pointing upwards in the spiritual sphere is paler, sort of more ethereal. And the one that goes down towards the earth is more an earthly colour. So these things are not incidental. I mean, Michelangelo understood the subtle symbolism of certain things that he was doing, because obviously Michelangelo had the help of a theologian, the official theologian of the church. There's always been debates as to who was the real theologian of the Sistine Chapel, but I would imagine maybe three or four of them. And again, you see these little figures that are near him. Sometimes he doesn't do his little tiny figures in these scenes in great detail. For example, the figure here in the background, hidden under the cloak, all you see is a head and it's very dark. The figure that's coming out is looking down, almost like it's looking towards the sun, because you see a sort of yellow area on the top of the head. And the figure on the other side looks like it's looking even at the moon. It's a paler colour. So you have this swirling movement. It's almost like he's coming out of a shell made of material, you know? So it's coming out and sort of floating over, and you can feel the power, the extreme, a great sense of power. Because obviously this is a spiritual creation. This is a spiritual division. It's a spiritual statement. But he tries to do this. He tries to give you this sense of the sacred in this particular image by the swirling movement and then the figure coming towards you. If you're looking at it in the Sistine, you feel like the figure is going to come down the chapel and literally come down right beside you in the chapel. Because the figures are so essential that you feel that you have an intimate relationship with the image that you're looking at. There's no sense here of being distant or trying to be standoffish in terms of, or more, let's say, contemplative in terms of image painting. Here you have a figure that's just swirling out of the sky, hovering in over and coming straight down to just create with a big explosion.
You were listening there to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently working at the American University of Rome. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.